Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's contentious hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee, at which Judge Kavanaugh's first accuser, Dr. Blasey Ford, testified, followed by Trump's embattled nominee for the Supreme Court. We'll begin with Kristen Clark, the President and Executive Director of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under the Law, who spent the day in the hearing rooms and joins us to discuss what seemed to be two entirely different hearings, the first half of which was calm and composed, and the second half of which was turbulent and emotional, with Judge Kavanaugh shouting between tears, fighting to save his reputation. We'll assess whether the Republicans were able to turn things around after Dr. Ford's very credible testimony, as they indignantly blamed everything on Senator Feinstein for allegedly leaking a letter and delaying the hearings, while they avoided any mention of the main issue at hand, which is whether or not Judge Kavanaugh engaged in sexual assault of three women and lied about it. Then we'll examine the whole process of the Senate confirmation of federal judges and the extent to which we can no longer pretend that the judicial branch is independent and nonpartisan. Paul Collins, Director and Professor of Legal Studies at the Department of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and co-author of Supreme Court Confirmation Hearings and Constitutional Change, joins us. With judicial confirmations descending into partisan brawls, starting with the Bork hearings, then the Thomas Anita Hill hearings, and now today's drama, we'll assess what possible path there is forward to restore dignity and respect to our courts. And then finally, we will speak with Aya Gruber, professor of law at the University of Colorado Law School, who has written widely on rape law and domestic violence reform and has a forthcoming book, The Feminist War on Crime. She joins us to discuss which one of the witnesses today displayed a judicial temperament after Dr. Ford showed quiet poise and restraint while Brett Kavanaugh went on a wild rant, blaming his predicament on the revenge of the Clintons, while wallowing in a woe-is-me tearful indignation as he exhibited a burning partisan contempt for the Democratic senators. The question then arises, what kind of a judge would Kavanaugh be on the Supreme Court, and what kind of treatment a Democrat appearing before him should expect? And joining us now is Kristen Clark, who's President and Executive Director of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. She formerly served as the head of the Civil Rights Bureau of the New York State Attorney General's Office and then spent several years at the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund working on cases defending the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act and also testified before Congress and state legislatures. She also worked at the United States Department of Justice in the Civil Rights Division, serving as a federal prosecutor in the criminal section of the division. And she's the author of Barack Obama and African-American Empowerment, The Rise of Black America's New Leadership. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kristen Clark.
Hi, good evening. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us, Kristen. And you were there. You witnessed it all. I, like most Americans, watched it on television, at least as much as I could, in between getting my day job together. So tell me, was it really, as I described, it felt like two different hearings?
It certainly did. I was seated just a few feet away from Dr. Christine Blasey Ford during her testimony this morning, and it was incredibly powerful to listen to her. She spoke in a very soft voice. They had to ask her to move closer to the mic. Her voice seemed to be cracking at moments, but overall, her story was incredibly consistent, and she spoke with great clarity about the things that she remembered, and she was honest about the details and facts that she didn't remember. And as the senators asked her to talk again and again about what happened, the consistency in her account and version of events rang was very apparent and very evident. I don't see how anyone could have listened to her story and not deemed her credible. I thought that some of the senators sadly were somewhat dismissive in terms of their posture and their facial expressions as she testified this morning. Senator Hatch, for example, seemed to wear a scowl on his face for much of the day. some of the senators seemed distracted and seemed not to be paying attention. But there were others who paid close attention to every word that she shared. And I don't see how anyone could have listened to her and not believe that she was being truthful. Now, what I think is open is that there are some questions about what Mark Judge would say if he were in that hearing room and took an oath before the senators and was asked to recount what he knows about the incident in that day. And it is unfortunate that we end the day with no real robust investigation having been carried out. I think if the FBI had been asked by the White House to look into this matter, today would have looked a little bit different. We would have had other testimony to help round out the accounts presented by Dr. Ford and Brett Kavanaugh. I leave the day feeling that it is just an unfortunate travesty that they moved forward and raced forward with a hearing today without the results, information, reports that may have been produced by the professionals at the FBI.
So do you think the Republicans succeeded in changing the subject? Clearly, the morning did not go well for them. But after they ditched the female prosecutor, they then went on the attack. The senators themselves started to testify, or not so much testify, but attack the Democrats. And the Democrats were trying to make the point that a FBI hearing is necessary to get to the bottom of this, to clear this, the judge if necessary. But the Republicans kept pounding on the idea that somehow this was all Senator Feinstein's fault for somehow leaking this letter and delaying this to the last minute. And that became their talking point. So do you think their talking points drowned out the what seems like a reasonable and logical thing, which is why not have an FBI investigation?
Yeah, there was clearly a playbook that guided their approach to the afternoon, one where they kept harping over and over again about the way that Senator Feinstein handled Dr. Ford's allegations. And I think that Senator Feinstein did the right thing. She tried her very best to respect the wishes of Dr. Ford, which was to keep her identity confidential. She turned these very serious and disturbing allegations about a lifetime nominee to the court over to the FBI at the 11th hour, but I think that was the right thing to do. The FBI, they are the ones who can ensure the safety of Dr. Ford and, more importantly, bring to bear their resources and professional staff, career law enforcement officers to help conduct forensic examinations, get records, documents, take testimony of reluctant witnesses like Mark Judge. I think she handled this in the right way, expecting that the FBI was going to step in and do just that, keep her identity confidential, keep her safe, get to the bottom of the allegations. And that didn't happen. Instead, what we've seen is a lot of finger pointing at Senator Feinstein, and that is most unfortunate. The only one that we should be pointing the finger at right now is the White House for their failure to call on the FBI to do exactly what happened during Anita Hill's investigation, open up a real robust investigation into these allegations here.
And again, I'm speaking with Kristen Clark, who's President and Executive Director of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. She formerly served as the head of the Civil Rights Bureau for the New York State Attorney General's Office and spent several years at the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund working on cases defending the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act, and also testified before Congress and state legislatures. And she also worked at the United States Department of Justice in the Civil Rights Division, serving as a federal prosecutor in the criminal section of the division, and she's the author of Barack Obama and African American Empowerment, The Rise of Black America's New Leadership. And she spent the day in the hearing room today. And so how much, though, do you think that Judge Kavanaugh was actually, in spite of the dramatics and the histrionics and the tears and the shouting, that he was actually basically playing to one, an audience of one, the very person who could make sure that he still kept his job, or at least until the vote is taken? Because immediately after the hearing adjourned, President Trump tweeted, "Judge Kavanaugh showed America exactly why I nominated him." And there were reports that on the plane coming down, on Air Force One coming down from New York after the UN session was over, he was watching it on TV. And when, of course, he watched Fox, which he always does. And when the anchor, Fox anchor, Chris Wallace, said at one point, after the testimony of Dr. Blasey Ford, said, you know, the Republicans have lost this one. That apparently alarmed him. And then I don't know whether he made a call or somebody made a call, but it does feel like Kavanaugh just came out swinging. He just was throwing everything at the mat.
It was astounding. You could hear a pin drop. I think that it probably caught many people in the room and who are watching by surprise. This is not the kind of temperament that you expect to see from somebody who is seeking Senate approval for a lifetime appointment to our nation's highest court. I'll be honest with you, I for a moment was wondering if he was preparing to withdraw his nomination, because the kind of fire and fury and his tone and the anger that he was lashing out with seemed to me to be somebody who was saying, I have nothing more to hold back on here. I'm just going to put all of my emotion out there nakedly for the public to see. And I thought there was a chance that he was preparing to withdraw his nomination, but instead he said, that's the last thing I'm going to do. I'm going to keep fighting. This is not the temperament, the judicial temperament that we expect to see from Supreme Court Justice. Nothing that he did this afternoon suggested that he is somebody who could be fair and even-tempered. He is somebody who is quick to get angry and will lash out. It was interesting to see the way that he cut many of the Senate Democrats off. He responded angrily to their questions. He trivialized some of their questions and was very respectful consistently to the other side. It's hard to believe that all Americans who stand up in a courtroom where he's presiding over would get fair treatment based on what we saw this afternoon.
Well, if he had, he exhibited a kind of burning contempt for the Democratic senators. So if he feels that way about Democratic senators, you can imagine what he feels about the average Joe who happens to be a vote Democrat.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that I wonder how people feel now when they appear in his courtroom. I've not personally appeared before him in the D.C. Court. But what we saw today suggests that if he has some sense of your political view, that that will certainly influence the treatment that you get from him as he's presiding over the court, and will influence how he's likely to interpret and handle matters that you present to him.
So given that he, at least to my mind, Kristen Clark, he was really playing to an audience of one. And as I mentioned, Donald Trump tweeted out today, "Judge Kavanaugh showed America exactly why I nominated him. His testimony was powerful, honest, and riveting. Democrat search and destroy strategy is disgraceful, and this process has been a total sham, and efforts to delay, obstruct, and resist. The Senate must vote." So what do you think? I mean, are they going to go ahead and vote tomorrow, at least in, voted out of the Judiciary Committee?
I think that there is a likelihood that he will, there will be a vote in the Judiciary Committee tomorrow. I think we'll have to wait and see what the outcome of that vote is. I did see one or two senators who seemed to take Dr. Christine Ford's allegations very seriously and to heart. Senator Flake, in particular, seemed very moved by her testimony, visibly moved. He seemed very reflective. He seemed to listen closely to every word that she shared this morning. But all that said, I think there is an expectation that there will be a vote in the Judiciary Committee tomorrow, and this will then proceed to a Senate floor vote. If I can, I will just share that yesterday, my organization, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, filed a federal lawsuit on behalf of Senator Merkley, because we can't forget that this nomination is one in which hundreds of thousands of documents pertaining to Mr. Kavanaugh's time in the White House remain outstanding. And that was something laid to bear during the first 4 days of the hearing, and something that we need not forget. I think that what we've seen makes clear that no senator can say that they are faithfully carrying out their constitutional obligation to provide advice and consent when documents that even Chairman Grassley wanted were ultimately blocked and denied by a White House that invoked executive privilege for the first time in our history in a way that denied the Senate access to the materials they needed to do their job. In every respect, this confirmation process has been broken, one shrouded in secrecy and none like any other we've seen in modern time. We filed our federal lawsuit with the hope that we can suspend this hearing, restore order and due process, and get the senator's time that they need to get his materials and make a decision about someone who's up for a lifetime appointment, fully informed and aware of all the documents and materials that we know are out there and that speak to who he is.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Kristen Clark, given that it seemed like the first witness, Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, actually had a very judicial temperament, and she was careful and extremely poised, whereas the judge himself was at times almost hysterical, shouting, weeping, a lot of histrionics. And as I mentioned before, it's felt to me at least that he was addressing an audience of one. So does this come down to the idea about the nation itself, about the battle for our better angels, in as much as, you know, if Kavanaugh wins and gets on the court, he will get on the court because of his Trumpian behavior. And we know that the Republican Party has become the party of Trump. And so, again, it seems that we're in a situation where if he wins, it's a victory for the worst kind of behavior.
I think that's right. I think that any senator, based on what they saw today, should have grave questions about his ability to be even-tempered on the court, should have questions about his ability to be fair, to handle sensitive issues regarding sexual assault that may come before him. He's a judge. He's handled cases involving defendants who believe that they were accused of things that they didn't carry out. And he knows that if a defendant were to conduct themselves in the way that he conducted himself today, that that's something that would be a strike against them. I hope that tomorrow we'll see a Senate Judiciary Committee prepared to slow down. There are these unresolved sexual assault allegations, and even if you choose to recklessly turn a blind eye to them, there is powerful testimony that we know is out there from people like Mark Judge, who needs to be subpoenaed to appear and testify under oath about what he knows. There's no way that Brett Kavanaugh should proceed to a lifetime appointment on our court with these kinds of dark clouds and unresolved questions and outstanding records all looming over him.
Well, Kristen Clark, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Kristen Clark, who's President and Executive Director of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. She formerly served as the head of the Civil Rights Bureau of the New York State Attorney General's Office and spent several years at the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund working on cases defending the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act, and also testified before Congress and state legislatures. And she also worked at the United States Department of Justice in the Civil Rights Division, serving as a federal prosecutor in the criminal section of the division. And she's the author of Barack Obama and African American Empowerment, The Rise of Black America's New Leadership. And she was spent the day in the hearing room before the Senate Judiciary Committee. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the whole process of the Senate confirmation of federal judges and the extent to which we can no longer pretend that the judicial branch is independent and nonpartisan. You can't hide your lying eyes, and your smile is a thin disguise. I thought by now you'd realize there ain't no way to hide your lying eyes. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Paul Collins, Director and Professor of Legal Studies in the Department of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, whose research interests include understanding the democratic nature of the judiciary, interdisciplinary approaches to legal decision-making, and social movement litigation. And he's the co-author with Laurie Ringhand of Supreme Court Confirmation Hearings and Constitutional Change. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Collins.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me on, Ian. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for joining us, Paul. And obviously today, I mean, if you go back to the Bork hearings and then the Thomas Anita Hill hearings, and then today, that trajectory would suggest that we're on a pretty partisan trajectory, perhaps irretrievably so. How does it strike you?
I agree. I think what we witnessed today was one of, if not the most partisan hearing in the history of confirmation hearings. Judge Kavanaugh came across as angry, partisan, and entitled, and I think this bodes very poorly for the future of the confirmation process.
But should he, I mean, shouldn't that disqualify him? I mean, in a curious and paradoxical way, as we were discussing with Kristen Clark, the first witness actually had a more judicial temperament, Dr. Blasey Ford, whereas the second, Judge Kavanaugh, didn't exhibit anything but a judicial temperament. And in fact, also exhibited a kind of burning, furious partisanship. He really spoke to the Senate Democrats with undisguised contempt.
I completely agree. I think one of the big takeaways today, outside of, you know, the veracity of his claims versus Professor Blasey Ford's claims, is his judicial temperament. One has to ask themselves whether his insistence, for example, that this is a partisan conspiracy will affect his decision-making. It's almost impossible to believe that a litigant representing the Democratic Party or a liberal interest group would feel that they could get a fair shake in front of Judge Kavanaugh after what we witnessed today.
So do you think that will come up? I mean, in this rush to confirm, I believe they're going to go ahead with the vote tomorrow on the Judiciary Committee and then try and get a quick vote in the Senate, the full Senate. Who's going to make that case? That it seems an obvious one. And of course, I think all of these antics today serve to distract from the real question, which was Judge Kavanaugh guilty of sexual assault of three separate women, and did he lie about it? I mean, do you think the Republicans were able to you know, take everybody's eye off the ball in by making this all about Senator Feinstein somehow leaking this letter, as opposed to what this hearing's really about?
I think the Republicans were quite successful in that. The format was unprecedented and very strange. It was a terrible format if the goal was to find the truth. It was quite difficult to tell where Rachel Mitchell was going with her questioning. But once the Republicans took over, once Lindsey Graham took over and then his colleagues on the Judiciary Committee followed what Senator Graham did, it really became a quite partisan hearing in which they very clearly had Judge Kavanaugh's back. So given that, you know, it seems that the Republicans kind of got wind in their sail once they took over from Rachel Mitchell in terms of the questioning.
So given that it seemed, I mean, I was suggesting earlier that it was almost like they got a phone call from the president, and maybe Kavanaugh was really auditioning for an audience of one, because after all, he doesn't want Trump to abandon him. And judging by Trump's subsequent tweets after the hearing's over, he's thrilled with what happened there. So what's your sense? Are they going to buffalo this thing through? I mean, how do we know how it's playing with the so-called moderates? Jeff Flake, he seemed to be, as Kristen Clark was saying, she was in the room, and she said she watched him during the Blasey Ford hearing. He seemed to be quite moved by her, but he's always voted pretty reliably with the Republicans. We don't know about the two women who are allegedly wavering, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski. So I'm just wondering about whether there'll be any more discussion, or will they just go straight to a vote?
Yeah, so obviously the very conservative Republicans on the committee are going to push for a vote as soon as possible. Flake, I have some doubts about where Flake stands right now. He obviously reacted very emotionally to Professor Blasey Ford's testimony. He seemed moved by it, but he also seemed moved by Judge Kavanaugh's testimony. I got the sense that he would like to hear a little bit more about the new accusations. It's clear that Senator Murkowski would also like to hear that. So the process might be slowed down, but it was hard not to get the sense that we might be right where we started this morning.
So do you think his opening statement, there was a lot of sort of woe is me, almost self-pity coming from him. But initially, when he really got emotional, where he basically blamed this on the Clintons. This is the revenge of the Clintons. That, of course, is in the kind of Alex Jones world of conspiracy. But does it play, do you think? How did it strike? Frankly, it struck me as so bizarre. And I felt that he actually believes it, that because he was so zealous on the Ken Starr committee, and there is a great irony that when he worked for Ken Starr, he really wanted in the questioning, the deposition of Bill Clinton, to have the most prurient details about Clinton's sexual encounters with the young White House intern. Do you think he believes that this is their payback?
If you take him at his word that he wrote his own opening statement, I think you have to think he believes that. I think what Judge Kavanaugh showed us today is what many people already knew, that he's a real, real partisan individual. And that could be problematic for Senators Collins and Murkowski. So if you juxtapose today with his previous hearing, he tried to paint himself as a very neutral, a very independent judge. Today, he came out, he looked like a politician. He looked like a very, very partisan Republican politician. I take him at his word that he wrote his own opening statement. I have very little doubt that the president nudged him in the direction to aggressively deny. That's right out of Trump's playbook.
Well, then the question would be, if this is the who he is, that he's, and I think it's pretty clear who he is. How much do you think we've gone down that rabbit hole? And we started, I mentioned, you know, the descent from Bork to Thomas Anita Hill now to the Kavanaugh hearings today. I mean, at what point do we have to sort of sober up here and take the scales off our eyes about the idea that the judicial branch is an independent branch and that our judges are nonpartisan?
Yeah, so I mean, I think we've come to realize, and public opinion polls show this, that Americans understand that judges are not nonpartisan, but we still sort of elevate judges beyond politicians. Today, you know, we sort of got a full look behind the cloak of what these judges are really like. And, of course, Judge Kavanaugh was selected in large part because of his background, in the Republican Party in particular. Now, what this means for the future, you know, maybe it's a new reality that we can stop pretending that judges aren't partisan, which, frankly, I would support frank conversations about how judges are ideological and how judges are partisan. I think it's a better conversation that we could have as a country than it is to just pretend as if they're not.
But do you think that just assuming that they can push this thing through and somehow they get all the Republicans to vote in lockstep and he gets on the court, I don't know what percentage of Americans, but an awful lot of Americans will always see him as a Republican political operative, which is what he was when he worked both in the White House and for Ken Starr. Is there any chance that there could be subsequent investigations, the very ones that they were calling for today, that could reach a point where there could be an impeachment?
I do think that's possible, if not probable. I think if the Democrats take the House in the midterms, they will probably open investigations. If the Democrats take the Senate in the midterms, they'll follow suit. That being said, there's no way that the Democrats will have the vote to actually remove him from office. But having the threat of impeachment always over his head is highly problematic. I mean, regardless of what happens, Judge Kavanaugh is always going to have this stigma associated with him, not just the allegations of sexual assault, but also what he demonstrated today, that he's a very, very partisan individual.
Well, that's, as I say, you know, I wouldn't want to go before him because I'm, a progressive who votes Democrat because... or even for Bernie. I mean, I'm even more to the left than the Democrats. So I'd be toast before him, right?
I certainly think that we have to question his objectivity here. No matter what he claims, like he did at his first hearing, to be objective, we know judges are not completely objective. I mean, the word itself indicates you have to exercise some type of discretion. So we finally got to see today, I think, the real Brett Kavanaugh, and that is a very, very partisan individual. And so I think you're right. I think if you're going to present progressive left causes in front of him, you should expect to lose.
But he went out of his way throughout the early hearings and indeed in today's hearings to say how he's always been fair and how people respect him for his fairness. Why didn't the Democrats, point that out, that everything he was saying in his strident defense of himself was, in fact, belies everything that he was claiming to be?
So I think they pointed it out at the first hearing. Certainly Senator Whitehouse from Rhode Island had lots of data demonstrating just how conservative Judge Kavanaugh is. Today, I don't think they had the time to bring it up. 5 minutes was just too little time to really get into any type of deep questioning, and the format really caused problems for this process.
Right, but Senator Whitehouse was going on about the yearbook, and Kavanaugh was being absolutely derisive and insulting in his response. Like, you know, go at it, you know, if you want to talk about a yearbook. And frankly, it did seem a little trivial. I mean, wouldn't it be more effective to basically said, wait a minute, you know, look, just look at what you're saying. Look at what you, how you're behaving. Look at the contempt you're showing us. Your hatred of Democrats is so manifest. Could you really be a fair judge? I mean, I guess I'm doing what, Monday morning quarterbacking here, but what's your take on it?
I think it would have been a good thing to point out. Now, the question is, the format didn't give a lot of time for that, but certainly Judge Kavanaugh was demonstrating his aggressiveness, I mean, at the very beginning with Senator Feinstein. And it followed the interruptions, raising his voice and practically yelling at senators, that I would have expected at least one senator or perhaps more to bring this up, bring up the judicial temperament issue.
Well, at the end of the day, though, from what we can understand, what we're hearing from the White House is that Trump is thrilled. He was very upset and very nervous, and he was very unhappy with Kavanaugh's appearance on Fox News. And by the way, the fact that he appeared on Fox News, to me, it reinforces what we've been talking about. It's like he's basically saying to the American people, I'm only interested in getting my point across to the one-third of the country that's in the Trump base that's locked in the Fox News bubble.
It was a very strange choice. It's unprecedented for a Supreme Court nominee to go on television to try to save their nomination. The choice of venue was just odd. Obviously, any media outlet in the country would have loved to have that interview. And by going on Fox News, I think his audience was the president. But then it wasn't a performance up to the president's standards on Fox News. And from what I understand, the president put a lot of pressure on him to behave as he did today. That is, to aggressively deny these allegations.
So in other words, President Trump may get his guy on the Supreme Court, but what do the American people get?
Well, I think we really have to have some serious conversations about the confirmation process. And I think perhaps more importantly, maybe we should start talking about term limiting Supreme Court justices.
Well, that's the feeling I have, is that this guy is going to be so bitter, so hateful, so spiteful towards anybody on the political left, anybody associated with the Democrats. And he's going to be taking out his grudges for decades to come.
That could be. I mean, we know from his voting record and his opinions on the Court of Appeals that he's a very, very conservative judge. Whether this will make him more conservative, you know, that's up in the air, because in some ways it's a little bit difficult to look at him and picture what a more conservative judge would be.
Well, Paul Collins, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, Ian. I appreciate it.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Paul Collins, Director and Professor of Legal Studies in the Department of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, whose research interests include understanding the democratic nature of the judiciary, interdisciplinary approaches to legal decision-making, and social movement litigation. And he's the co-author of Supreme Court Confirmation Hearings and Constitutional Change. We're going to take a brief station break and back, looking further into the judicial temperament on display today.
You're nothing but a dirty, dirty old man. You do your thinking with a one-track mind. Keep talking about heaven, glory, but on your face is a different story. Clean up your rap, your story's getting dusty. Wash out your mouth, your lies are getting rusty. Can't believe nothing you say, 'cause I'm around and I see what you do.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Aya Gruber, who's a professor of law at the University of Colorado Law School, who teaches and writes in the areas of criminal law and procedure, comparative and international law, critical theory, and feminism. She has written widely on rape law, the feminist critique of provocation and self-defense, domestic violence reform, and on prostitution and human trafficking. And her forthcoming book is tenderly titled The Feminist War on Crime. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ira.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, thank you, Iron. Today, there were sort of two universes at display at the hearing, first with Dr. Blasey Ford and then later with Judge Kavanaugh. And how did it strike you in terms of judicial temperament? Because the irony seemed that the first witness seemed sort of composed and careful and judicious, whereas the second witness, Judge Kavanaugh, was defiant, strident, shouting between tears, blaming his whole predicament on the revenge of the Clintons.
It was a surreal experience to watch this hearing unfold. If you were to ask me, if I had no idea about the history of this hearing, and you were to ask me, which is the person who's up for a Supreme Court? Who has the judicial temperament? I would have said Dr. Ford. She was calm and she answered questions directly. She was non-combative. There was moments where you could tell she was trying to control her emotions, but she was trying to be professional and respectful. And it was such a contrast when you saw this emotionally distraught Judge Kavanaugh, who was alternately angry and upset and sometimes couldn't control his emotions, and at other times seemed dismissive. It almost felt like a strange role reversal.
But did it work to the extent that in the afternoon, after they had ditched the female prosecutor who was asking questions on behalf of the Republican senators, when the Republican senators came on, particularly Lindsey Graham, who really fired a broadside at his Democratic colleagues, it sort of felt like the Republicans had very cleverly shifted the focus entirely away from Judge Kavanaugh and whether or not he was guilty of sexual assault with these three women and whether he had lied about it. That's ostensibly what the whole hearing was supposed to be about. And then in the second half of the day, it was almost all about procedure and about whether or not Senator Feinstein had leaked a letter. Do you think they were successful in distracting from what the hearings ostensibly were supposed to be about?
I think that remains to be seen. Certainly with their base, you know, they're grasping for reasons why these very explosive and very credible allegations shouldn't disqualify their nominee. And so, of course, they're going to say, oh, you know, this is Democratic partisan performance art, and they're going to, you know, throw everything they can at it. Now, I think that's going to satisfy the base of the Republican Party. I think the base of the Republican Party thought that before the hearing and is probably very happy that you had a bunch of angry Republicans kind of screaming and shouting in a way they probably wanted to when Dr. Blasey Ford was testifying, but couldn't in fear of how that would make them look. I think you probably have a lot of people in the base that are satisfied with that. The question is whether the people who were honestly trying to figure out the question of whether this person, whether there was enough evidence to make us question whether we should move to the next qualified Supreme Court candidate, because there was enough question about this person's character from this very serious allegation of wrongdoing when they were a high school student. Will those people be swayed by the it's all Dianne Feinstein's fault? I'm not 100% sure, because even if we granted the Republican argument that the Democrats gleefully held on to this evidence till the 11th hour, it doesn't make the evidence less true. I mean, it's still out there that we had this very credible witness saying that she 100% remembers that this judge did this to her. And that's still out there.
And again, I'm speaking with Aya Gruber, who's a professor of law at the University of Colorado Law School, who teaches and writes in the areas of criminal law and procedure, comparative and international law, critical theory, and feminism. She has written widely on rape law, the feminist critique of provocation and self-defense, domestic violence reform, and on prostitution and human trafficking. And her forthcoming book is tentatively titled The Feminist War on Crime. But do you think, I mean, I'm not sure everybody, you know, obviously your profession and my profession to watch these hearings, but I'm not sure the average person had the whole day to spare. But if they did, at the end of the day, do you think Dr. Ford's message sort of got lost or overshadowed?
It's possible. But, I think that there was a shift from the morning in which, you know, here was a very credible witness who answered questions and seemed very concerned with being accurate and telling the truth. And that was a bad moment for Kavanaugh. And I think after the break and after Kavanaugh came on, it was kind of, devolved into yelling and accusations and people charging that this is a circus and a disgrace. And it became very political at that point. And I think that may satisfy some people in the Republican Party that it's just so political they don't know what to believe. But I'm not sure it will satisfy people that they have their eye on the main issue, which is, is this true?
Well, exactly. But my feeling is that in spite of all of the hysterics and theatrics and the woe is me wallowing in self-pity that came from Judge Kavanaugh, I felt all along that this was really, he was playing to an audience of one, and that is Donald Trump. And apparently earlier in the day, Donald Trump was flying back from the UN in Air Force One, watching the first half of the day with Dr. Ford's testimony. And he, of course, naturally, he only watches Fox News. And Chris Wallace, who was moderating the interstitials between the testimony, at one point apparently said, particularly referring to the female prosecutor that they brought in to give them kind of cover, saying this is a disaster for the Republicans. So without being conspiratorial, it's almost like they got a phone call from the president. Kavanaugh said, unless you turn this around, you're toast, buddy.
Well, I think, Trump was signaling that the whole time. And I try very hard in my life not to channel what Donald Trump might think. But I couldn't help myself when watching Kavanaugh testify. And I said, on the one hand, he's kind of belligerent and mean and petulant. Donald Trump's going to love that. On the other hand, he's crying. And Donald Trump might not like that. So I found myself in this weird sort of moment where I'm trying to channel how, Kavanaugh might come off to his audience of one. But remember that audience of one made it very clear in his news conference and his reaction to the Fox News interview that he really wanted a sort of fired up Kavanaugh, and he loved the fired up Lindsey Graham. On the other hand, there's Senator Collins, there's Senator Murkowski, there are other senators involved who might not have Donald Trump's sensibilities and might not have liked that performance. I don't know. I'm not in all of their heads, and I think it's going to depend to a large extent on what we see tomorrow, what clips get played, what's the narrative of how this hearing went. But I'm just not sure that tactic worked. I think the combative, cutting people off, talking points tactic that Kavanaugh used was probably one that he had prepared beforehand. But the breaking down and crying and the failing to be in control of his emotions, I actually think that was genuine. I think that, he was at the top of his high school and a football player and beloved by people. He went to Yale. He became a very important judge. He worked in the White House as a young man. He's lived a very storied and privileged life where people have really liked him. And I'm sure this is a very terrible moment for him. That being said, I'm a former defense attorney, and I can tell you that being really upset at finding yourself in a terrible position in your life and the allegations being untrue are not the same thing. I had many clients who, they did it, but they were still very upset at what was happening in their lives, and understandably so. So, I do think that, it's pretty terrible what's happening to him and his family, and I don't think that he deserves sort of like social media death or never to teach again. I mean, I think it would depend on a fuller investigation of these claims, how harshly we should judge him. Do I think that given Dr. Blasey Ford and her lack of motivation to lie and her credibility, that this would be enough evidence for me to say, look, I'm not sure whether he did it or not, but I think there's enough of a question out there that I don't want him to be, you know, on a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court. I think that's fair. I think it's fair to say that this evidence is pretty serious. And if I were making a decision about somebody, hiring somebody to be very important in my life, to work in my household or something like that, I might want to know about it. And it might lead me to go to the next qualified candidate. That is a question. That being said, there's obviously not enough evidence to convict him in a court of law. Absolutely not. And the reason why there's not enough evidence is no prosecutor in their right mind would go to a trial like the day after somebody came in with a claim without a police investigation.
Well, that was very much at the heart of the Democrats' argument all along, that why not an FBI investigation? And it does seem that's a reasonable thing. And even though Kavanaugh himself was asked that question many times, he dodged it. He refused to. He went along with the Republicans, who, for what I can't even recall what their basic excuse was. They mostly were blaming it all on the Democrats not sticking to procedures and somehow springing this on, or as Lindsey Graham said, ambushing them. Do you think at the end of the day, again, we're both trying to put ourselves in the position of the average viewer, do you think that the average viewer might have thought, well, that makes sense? You know, you've got these accusations out there. You've got these three women, only one of whom they allowed to speak. Maybe the FBI should look into this.
Yeah, I just think it's a series of bad calls, you know, and the Republicans want to blame the Democrats, particularly Dianne Feinstein, for sitting on the letter and then it leaked somehow. And the Democrats want to blame the Republicans for, once it leaked, not sort of halting things and having an investigation. And we kind of ended up in a big circus, but we have to remember what's pushing this to a circus-like atmosphere. And it's one thing. It's the midterm elections. And so the Republicans really didn't want to run up against the midterm elections. And once they committed to Kavanaugh, when the allegations first came out, it's conceivable that they could have just said, you know what, we don't even want to go there. This is going to be like really just too much for everybody involved. I think we should try to convince the president to go to the next candidate. We can still get our Federalist Society conservative on the Supreme Court. We could still possibly threaten Roe v. Wade. We can still do all these things. They could have done that, but they didn't. They decided to stick with Kavanaugh. Now, why? I don't know. Maybe they really just were outraged that this was an 11th hour thing. Maybe, you know, President Trump was thinking about Kavanaugh's position on how you shouldn't be investigating or indicting a sitting president. Who knows why they stuck with him, but they did. Now, they could have also stuck with him and said, look, we've got these allegations. We're going to halt the hearings, have a confidential, you know, investigation involving objective law enforcement agents or some other objective investigative body, and then we're going to decide whether we even need a hearing, right, to spare everybody this kind of spectacle and terrible national pain people are feeling. But that didn't happen. Instead, I think the idea was, if we go forward with a hearing right away, we can still be on our timeline and we can get all through all this, and then, you know, the midterm elections won't matter. But to me, even if this all goes the Republicans' way, even if they get Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court, and even if this doesn't hurt them in the midterms, I think there's a larger wound that's going to fester because of this. And I think that these two parties, you know, Kavanaugh is always going to have this stain, and it's going to be a big one. And, you know, Dr. Ford, she, you know, may just be an anecdote in history, but this isn't good for her life either. So whoever you want to blame, we are where we are. We're in the midst of a pretty terrible national moment in which the politics of sexual assault and the politics of the day are making a spectacle out of what should be a serious and probably a confidential matter. And that's seating somebody on the most important court in the nation. So I don't know. I just think that whoever you blame, we are where we are. It's a terrible moment, but we still have to resolve the issue at hand, which is, whether we have enough evidence, and remember, we have a credible witness who says she is 100% sure that Kavanaugh, in his teens, committed a pretty serious crime against her, and there's not really great evidence to sort of undermine her credibility. So our question is whether that is enough for us to say, look, in an abundance of caution, we're going to move on to the next candidate. That's the question at hand. That's what people should concentrate on. And if they're okay with it, then they're okay with it. If they're okay with that job, you know, being vetted in a way in which you can have people claim you attempted to rape them credibly, if you could still, if they think it's still okay that you get that job because enough time has passed or for whatever other reason, then that's their decision. But people shouldn't lose sight of the fact that that is the question. Whether an allegation that has the level of proof of that allegation should reflect on somebody who's seeking a seat on the highest court in the land for his life.
So just in the last couple of minutes, I agree, but do you think they're going to go ahead and have their vote tomorrow on the Judiciary Committee and then try and force a quick vote Monday or Tuesday, which is what they seem to be doing?
I think they're going to vote. I think they're going to vote on the Judiciary Committee. I don't know. I mean, I'm not, you know, I don't have a crystal ball on that one. But, I mean, it, you know, I stopped watching the hearings right towards the end, so I didn't see the very end of it. I'm still waiting to watch that. But if any indication of how the first sort of 60% of the Kavanaugh portion of the hearing went and the level of heat that the Republicans put into it and the level of fire they have right now, it seems to me they're going to vote, at least in the Judiciary Committee. Now, I think they have to do some poll watching and news watching and, you know, straw polls of their fellow senators to determine what they want to do about the full vote. But from what I saw, at least in the second half of the proceedings, it seems like the Judiciary Committee will proceed.
Well, Aya Gruber, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Aya Gruber, who's a professor of law at the University of Colorado Law School, who teaches and writes in the areas of criminal law and procedure, comparative and international law, critical theory, and feminism. She has written widely on rape law, the feminist critique of provocation and self-defense, domestic violence reform, and on prostitution and human trafficking. And her forthcoming book is tentatively titled The Feminist War on Crime. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Love.